Welcome back, everyone. I'm Pierre Daly. This is Insight is Capital. Imagine you're launching a business where your biggest competitors charge nothing, where your entire P&L is public, where raising $100 million is considered a minor miracle, and most products never get there, where the graveyard of good ideas is bigger than the winner's circle. That's not a cautionary tale. That's Tuesday in the ETF industry. Eric Balchunas calls it the Terror Dome, and nobody has mapped it more precisely or more honestly than he has. Eric is senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, co-host of the Trillions podcast, and the closest thing the ETF industry has to an embedded anthropologist. He's tracked thousands of fund launches, flows, closures, and fee wars, and he's developed a vocabulary for this market that's become the industry's shared language. Terror Dome, mutual fund in a Halloween costume, niche killers. If you work in or around ETFs, you've definitely borrowed his words. He publishes Bloomberg Intelligence's annual ETFs to watch list, this year, 26 for 26, and his read on where the industry is heading tends to be early, specific, and uncomfortable for the people it's about. We're going to spend the next hour or so in two places inside the Terror Dome, what it actually costs to survive this market as an issuer, and then on the watch list, looking at the products he thinks tell us something real about where the industry is going in 2026 and beyond.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Eric, welcome. Welcome back. It is great to have you and get this chance to catch up with you.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for that very nice introduction.
You're welcome. Well deserved. Eric, how have you been? What's new? Where are you coming to us from today?
I'm in Philadelphia. It's Friday, and I'm working at my home desk, and my job really is to just crank out these research notes. And so most of my week is just in the research cave, cranking out these notes. And then I, on Monday in particular, I go out and talk about the notes a lot. But I'm also sort of trying to like use our emails and social media and our newsletter to get, you know, you have to be your own marketing person these days. So yeah, we write the notes and then we try to get attention to the notes. And I manage a team of about 10 people, and we all just, we're like ETF nerds. One guy's a mutual fund analyst, and so he has to deal with us trashing mutual funds a lot, but we realize they're not going away anytime soon, and there's some good ones out there. So that's what we do. That's what I do all week, and that's what I'm doing today.
Eric, it's been quite a surprising year as well, and you know, a lot of things that investors thought would be likely to happen didn't. One thing that I, you know, love that you do is that, you know, you have a great way of tearing apart or dissecting, you know, the business and seeing, you know, what the incumbents are doing, what the, you know, very like super large issuers are doing in terms of how they're capturing flows. But you're also very closely watching what's going on in the more nascent spaces of the ETF industry where companies are launching new products, new strategies, new alternative strategies, the derivative-based income space. You've used the word Terror Dome for years now to describe this ETF competitive landscape. And for advisors and allocators who hear that term and think it's just industry color, what's actually the structural reality underneath it?
Yeah. That term comes from a Public Enemy album called Welcome to the Terror Dome. And, you know, Chuck D's talking about, you know, the inner city. But the sound of that song and the phrasing really, I think, strikes me as what it's like to launch an ETF. It's very hard. And there's a couple times over the years where I was like, damn, this industry is brutal. I would almost compare mutual funds are a little more like a country club, you know, and the ETF world is much more like a war zone. And the reason is when you launch an ETF, you don't have any assets, right? You have to get something going, and there's no distribution fees. And mutual funds spent, you know, they built the business with just giving brokers fees to just put someone in the fund. You don't have that. So you have to like earn all your dollars. And when you enter the ETF space, so you have to get everything on your own. So you are on your own. And number two, you are up against BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street. And Vanguard in particular, you know, they're kind of the creators of the Terra Dome. They have been lowering fees for so many years. And now they offer almost, I mean, honestly, you can get more than a core. You can get your core portfolio and even some satellite positions for like under 10 basis points. And people, an entrusted brand that has never had really any controversy over 50 years. That's powerful. So Vanguard has made everybody have to have a lineup of cheap funds. And so BlackRock is right there with them. And so between BlackRock and Vanguard having all this stuff, all this exposure for almost like no fee, you're basically left with, you know, competing on either differentiation, you have to have some performance issue or potentially lower fees in a category that isn't low fee already. And it takes time and it's very difficult. I remember when there was a case of a Vanguard launching a muni bond ETF and BlackRock immediately cut the fee from MUB. MUB was the biggest muni bond ETF on the market. It cut the fee from like something like 25 basis points to like 8. And that was the number one ETF in this category. It was the most liquid, the biggest, and BlackRock. But BlackRock basically cut off like both arms and a leg just to try to deal with the Vanguard coming into the category. So if a big issuer is doing stuff like that, that trickles down into the whole industry. And so it is just a really brutal market. So what you have going on now is you have a lot of people don't even want to fight Vanguard and BlackRock. They're like, I'm not even dealing with the core. So they launch a lot of crazy stuff, you know, hot sauce, as I call it. So you see this huge influx hot sauce products because they can charge more. People who are going to use something that's more volatile as 1% of the portfolio or a small, you know, just a small allocation, they have less fee sensitivity. So the core is really the heart of the Terra Dome. The hot sauce area is a little less governed by those physics, but you have to get lucky a little bit. You got to put the right product out at the right time, get some performance. So that's why you see like, and there is, sometimes there's terms that I didn't come up with that are used, like Ben Johnson calls it the spaghetti cannon in terms of how many products are just being thrown at the wall. And a lot of those are like pretty wild products. The only other thing I would add to this is that what you also find going on is a lot of these legacy active managers are coming into the ETF space and they're finally finding some success, and it's because they got cheap. So even though they're not as cheap as Vanguard or BlackRock in the core, they've come down to below 40 basis points. So what you used to pay for like a really reputable active mutual fund, 80 to 100 basis points,
right,
you now pay 30 or less. So they've basically given the I-class pricing to everybody. And this is why active is finally taking off. For many years, these managers wanted the ETF to play on its terms, but they realized they had to play on the ETF industry's terms. And so JP Morgan, Capital Group, DFA, Avantis, those are the firms that led the way with lower cost active. And it turns out advisors do want active. They're open to it, but they want to feel like they get a good deal and they want to not pay for beta because beta is now free thanks to Vanguard. So there's a huge repricing going on. You really have to be cheap or shiny, basically. And that's sort of the really, I'd say probably the number one governing dynamic of the Terra Dome. You can be cheap or shiny, or you better have some relationships where, you know, the advisors just owe you something because you gave them golf balls or something. Like you got to have something up.
Yeah.
So we have three C's for ETF success: cheap, creative, or Cabernet.
That's excellent.
Those three things kind of explain about 98% of the flows.
I think, you know, I was an advisor. When I was an advisor, the chief product, you know, managed, you know, fund product was a mutual fund. And, you know, as to your point, they had fees. They had a lot of incentives for advisors to recommend. They were pretty much equal across the board. So, you know, you still had to go through your selection process. But the management fees, compared to today's management fees, were you know, astronomical relative. I mean, we were talking, you know, funds with management fees of 1.5% to 3%. You've talked about this $100 million threshold being the rough comfort threshold. Like, just getting there is the line between a fund that has a future and one that's on life support. And you can see where advisors would be hesitant, even if they love the idea of what a particular ETF is doing. You can see where they'd be hesitant to put money, allocate money to those ETFs, because they're wondering, are you going to make it? How do I know you're going to make it? And so that's really the bar that's moved, right? Has that bar moved? And in a world where a dozen new ETFs launch every week, Eric, what does it actually take to cross that mark in 2026 and forward versus what it took 5 years ago?
Yeah. Good question. There's 2,000 ETFs that are below $50 million, which I think is the line from becoming like vital versus being a zombie. But to your point, I don't think advisors really want to mess with anything till it's $100 million. So then you get up to about like 3,500 ETFs. So like half of the ETFs are below $100 million. And there's like 5,200 ETFs. So there's going to be a lot of liquidations. On average, about a quarter of all ETFs launched will go away. That number actually could tick up given how many launches we have. We used to have one launch a day. That was like the standard for like 10 years. The last 2 years, there's four a day. So it's quadrupled. And a lot of these ETFs aren't going to make it, you know? So I think the liquidation rate could go up to 30, 35. Like a third of all ETFs launched could eventually close. And issuers are like less stigmatized by it. They just like launch it. If it doesn't work, they close it. So the average age of a closed ETF is also coming down, because they have less patience. And again, this is also because a lot of the products launched are like supposed to be shiny objects and hot sauce. So if they don't hit right away, they're gone. But there are other products that come out where someone has a really good idea, or it's an active manager like Hartford Group or someone who's just like legacy. And they'll hang a little longer. You know, they're like, look, I think we have a good idea. We'll give it time. And that usually works. Like if you can just like commit to 4 years of like trying to get this ETF going, you'll probably succeed. But a lot of people can't make it that far. It's hard because you're, again, it's guerrilla marketing. You see other people strike it rich near you and it's like frustrating. So I think the main thing is to be patient and consistent, and you can make it. So the barrier to entry of ETFs is very low. Anybody can launch an ETF, especially with white label issuers. Like you and I could launch one today if we had $80,000, we'd just call up one of the white labels, get our ETF out. Getting money into it is very different. And I have seen the ETF industry humble some old school active managers from like who are like kind of stuck culturally in the 90s. Maybe not culturally, but I'm stuck music-wise in the 90s, but they're stuck market-wise in the 90s. And they're like, oh, my IP is so important. I don't want anybody to see what stocks I own. A, nobody cares. B, I'm worth 80 bips. No, you're not. And like, I've seen many of them get humbled, and it's part of the process. So whether you're like a new manager or an old one, I think the ETF industry can be humbling at first. However, if you make it, if you can get something going, it's very good, because the rising tide is there. Like you have flows coming in all over the place. This is where the fish are biting. So you're at least you're fishing in the right place. And that's why over time, if you get the word out and hopefully get some benefit from the market gods, where the thing you're doing actually has a good run of outperformance, you can do it. And there's a pretty good middle class where there's a bunch of products between 100 million and a billion, probably like over 1,000 products live there. And we don't, you know, I'd probably be stumped to even really explain half of them, because there's so many and they're so different that it's hard to know everyone inside and out. I used to have a grip on all of them. I could almost name like half the tickers at one point. Now it's just impossible. But then there are times when you go from the middle class to you hit it big. And that's possible too. And that's interesting when that happens. Most Vanguard products are going to hit it big, either slowly or quickly, because they're Vanguard and their distribution is big. And BlackRock's similar. But it's the smaller ones that, you know, it's harder, But if they hit it big, they have less overhead, so they can be profitable quickly. You know, one ETF that just came out that was total shocker. This is like the Blair Witch Project, right? You know how that movie was filmed, what, camcorder, and they made like all this money? DRAM, which is DRAM, it's a memory ETF from Romulus, came out. It's only 60 days old. It's got $15 billion. So it got to $15 billion in 60 days. That's insane. Like even the iShares Bitcoin ETF, which had broken all the records, DRAM got to $15 billion 2 days ahead of IBIT. The next one down is like a country mile. Like those two are in a league of their own in terms of growth. But the Bitcoin one I understand more, I think, in retrospect, because people waited 11 years for a Bitcoin ETF. This memory ETF just came out of the blue. I was not really focused on it. And I was like, I traded $200 million the first day. I'm like, wow. So sometimes you get these really instant hits that's almost like an indie movie going big time. And I cover those a lot because those are rare. BlackRock and Vanguard, their products tend to get bigger and bigger. They get less coverage from us, but they're equally as important. But those, by the way, let me give you a stat. I just want to give you this stat that's like,
yeah,
this is a great Teradome stat. Capital Group is probably one of the best examples of a legacy manager that came in, lowered their fees, and has had success. They have 25 ETFs, and 21 of them are over $1 billion. They've seen flows every month. Some's from their mutual funds, but it doesn't matter. They've done well. I think they're at $150 billion or something like that. They are a total like hit. They're a success story. They have less than 1% of the assets of all ETFs. After 5 years of that and their capital group, they're the biggest active mutual fund manager on the planet, and it had good success, and they're still under 1%. BlackRock and Vanguard each have 30% market share. JP Morgan's another one. They've had total success. I mean, they're a blueprint for how to make it. They have 2% market share. So, you know, Roundhill, I just talked about DRAM, they have less than 50 basis points market share. So these stories that get big are interesting, and they're great, and you want to show this because it is so against the odds. But sometimes I take a step back and you look at Vanguard and BlackRock. I guess that's sort of the way that sometimes you would look at planet Earth within the Milky Way galaxy, and then you realize how small you really are.
Yeah.
So that big, and BlackRock and Vanguard take in about 50, 60% of all the money. So they punch at their weight. So the good news is if ETFs take in 1.3 trillion, 1.5 trillion a year, 40% of that number is still a lot of money. But that gives you like 300 issuers fighting over 40%, whereas two issuers get 60.
That's extraordinary.
Vanguard are. It's like it makes your brain hurt almost.
That's extraordinary. That's like an astonishing, those are astonishing numbers.
And you as an advisor would appreciate this. We had a note where we said that BlackRock and Vanguard are the new IBM for advisors, because advisors, it used to be said, if you could never get fired for putting the client in IBM, because it's such an evergreen blue chip stock, like nobody could ever get mad at you. And I think that now applies to Vanguard and BlackRock ETFs. Like it'd be hard to get fired by a client if you're in those, because they're just very highly fiduciary. And that's how I think evergreen they are. They are actually very much, because if you look at advisor surveys for what they like in ETFs, what they think about when they pick one, the number one and number two are brand and fees. So that definitely goes right to BlackRock and Vanguard in terms of playing into their favor. And that's why they are so dominant. So it kind of fulfills itself. The bigger you get and the more trusted and brand worthy you get, the more people just buy your stuff. I think most industries are like this. They're generally dominated by two or three massive companies, and sort of we got the same here. But this is different because back in the mutual fund days, it wasn't as dominant. They were much more dispersed in terms of all these different asset managers. But the ETF industry is turning more into like a regular industry where, you know, two-thirds of the assets are within like two or three companies.
Yeah, it's incredible when you know, I had an interesting conversation with somebody, you know, where I realized, you know, when you look at the index world, or you look at the rules-based or evidence-based investing world, where, you know, you're getting into things like, multi-factor models, things like Dimensional and Avantis that you mentioned, the attraction there for advisors and investors alike is that it's still like, even with the, you know, the systematic nature, the rules-based nature of those actively managed funds versus index, there's still an element of agnosticism, right? About picking these managers and picking these, you know, the ETFs. And you can see where advisors like, you know, have, you know, one thing advisors really like about the index world is that it's not, it's still something you can point to as being an objective selection to invest in index funds, because there's no active criticism. There's no way to actively criticize the market. You know, it's the market. You can't, whatever happens in the S&P 500, that's what you got. But if somebody's actively managing a market, or, you know, constituents in a market in an actively managed stock picking fund, you can, if it doesn't perform, you're not going to sit there and say, well, that's the market. You're going to sit there and you're going to say, that's the manager. So that's the big active risk, right? That's the risk of being an active manager, is that you'll get blamed if it doesn't work out. The DRAM story is extraordinary. I agree with you that, you know, that kind of attraction, you know, getting $15 billion in 60 days is extraordinary. What do you think is the main reason? Is it because it offers access to difficult to access markets like Korea?
Yes. DRAM really did two things that are highly valuable. One, it had a shiny object moment right out of the gate. I mean, it's only 2 months old and it's up 132%. I mean, that's going to get looks regardless. The other thing it did was it found that there was this frenzy to get high bandwidth memory stocks because AI data centers are, there's basically a supply shortage of these high bandwidth memory chips and services. And there's only three companies that dominate that market: SK Hynix, Samsung, and Micron. And Micron is obviously available. That's a US stock. But the other two were not available. There was no ADR format, so you couldn't get them. And so people were using the South Korea ETF as a backdoor way to get those two stocks. But then you'll get Micron with that one. Roundhill, I guess, saw this. And so we'll get all the stocks via swap contracts and we'll put them all in the ETF, where the three stocks are almost the whole fund. So let's just not even mess around with diversification. You just want these three, we'll give it to you. And so it's highly concentrated, but very convenient and very powerful. So it was probably one of the most brilliant launches ever, in terms of not just being having the perfect timing and seeing around a corner, but the design made real sense. It had a lot of bang for the buck, because people using this aren't looking to for like a vanilla diversification tool. Like, this is not like for Vanguard people. They wanted hot sauce, and they want to speculate on this really momentum-filled rally in these three stocks. And so this ETF just did their homework, you know, because there are other ETFs that hold some of those stocks, but not nearly in those weights, and not all three at once. So it really filled the market void, and the timing was absolutely perfect. So yeah, it's very rare. These are like, again, four-leaf clovers. It's very rare this happens, but
yeah,
it does. It's just, it's exciting, because it's like, especially when it's one of the smaller issuers like Roundhill, because there's no help there. Sometimes you see a fund get like a bunch of assets early and it's like, I don't know, Allianz or something. And you're like, how'd this happen? And you realize they just, somebody from Allianz who runs a model, they just put the ETF in there. We call that BYOA, bring your own assets.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Bink, I wouldn't say Bink's interesting. Rick Rieder's fund also was growing very quickly, but there's some BlackRock help there. And also he's just very well known. Same with Tom Lee,
yeah.
GR Granny ETF did very well.
Granny shots, yeah.
Yeah. But yep. DRAM, again, has none of those things going for it. It's pure grassroots hit, and that's really rare.
Just straight access.
That's it. It's so on fire. It's like a euphoric situation for those stocks right now.
Yeah, it sure is. Eric, of all the, you know, 2026 has been a really interesting year. At the beginning, you launched your 26 for 26 ETFs to watch list. How is that? First of all, how has that panned out? And secondly, if you're looking around right now, what is the thing that piques your interest or excites you the most right now in the ETF space?
The watch list is going pretty well. I think, you know, one of the ETFs that I picked on the watch list, I picked URNM, which is uranium mining. I think that's an interesting ETF. I've been long into this one because it's like a backdoor play on AI. A lot of energy that AI needs is way beyond like solar and wind for sure. And there are all these big Mag 7 companies are building little nuclear centers to use nuclear energy. And so they need uranium. So that's one that has done pretty well. What else we look at? Oh, I know another one we look at is auto callables. So the CalArabs has an auto callable ETF, CAIE. And this one is $1 billion. And it's came out a year ago and it's had flows every single week. What are auto callables? They're very complicated, but basically it's like a structured note that a lot of institutions have used. Again, they're just democratizing something that's been used with institutions, but you basically get a coupon unless the market goes down like 40%, then the coupon gets called. So it's sort of like, if it's something to use, if you think the market won't like totally crash and burn, they give you some yield. And the current yield on this is, 14%. And so this is going to compete with like the JEPIs of the world. JEPI and JEPQ are the ETFs that do covered call strategies. So auto callables are almost like taking covered calls and getting a little crazier and trying to get you more yield. Very complicated though. Like if you really dig into these and try to explain how they work there, we did a podcast on it with the Calamos guy and it helped a little, but it's very complex. But I think a lot of times with ETFs, you know, you want to go with issuers you trust. If you don't totally understand the strategy, a multi-factor ETF can also be very complicated. You know, how do they pick the stocks? And I think a lot of people tend to just like talk to the issuers and they just have a trust with the issuers. It's their name on the tin. And the ETF industry has a nice, good halo above it. So I'm not against auto callables and I could see why they're successful, but they are complicated. But that yield is pretty valuable, 14%. That's more than JEPI's 9% and JEPQ is what, like 12%. And it's way more than bonds. And so I think there's going to be a growth in the derivative income space for a while, I think, between JEPIs, auto callables, and that's a big area. And then the other one, I put one, a buffer ETF in my 26 to watch. I put the one that Goldman bought. I think it was a ticker, BFUR. No, Buff B. That's it. It was Buff B. But anyway, the reason Buff B was in mine was because it's laddered buffer. And I think when it comes to buffers, these are structured products that like lock in a certain amount of downside or none at all. And boomers love these because they're happy to give up upside to secure less downside, sleep at night. They're kind of like anxiety buffers, these buffer ETFs. And so the problem is when you buy them, you have to like redo a new one in a year. And so they launch every quarter so you can go in and out at the right times. Well, these laddered ones, they just do all that for you. So it's a little extra fee, but you'll have to worry about it. So this is the Innovator Laddered Allocation Buffer, and it's got 300 million, but the First Trust one is the big one. But I was watching this one because Innovator was bought by Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs is big, has a bunch of distribution. So I was curious to see if the Goldman Sachs Innovator brand would get big and challenge First Trust more. And this is a big battle. Those are the two heavyweights in the buffer category. So it used to be Innovator versus First Trust. Now it's Goldman versus First Trust. So it's kind of got a little more juice to that matchup. But those are some of the ones I watched. I'm trying to recall what other ones, but those are some that stand out, at least in my mind right now.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, do you think that the rise of interest that you're looking at is that in proportion to the concentration, you know, the worry about concentration risks in the equity market? Like in particular, like the auto callables, a lot of those structured note products are that are within the ETF are equity linked, right? And they provide a yield, like you said, it's like, you know, covered calls plus. So it's a little bit more than a covered call. It's not exactly a covered call ETF, but it's similar in the way that it derives the income. But it also provides a buffer as well, like similar to buffered ETFs, auto callable notes, right? Do you think the popularity of covered call ETFs has risen dramatically in the last couple of years? Do you think it's in proportion to that fragility of the market that people are fearing?
Yeah. Concentration is very worrying to people. I think the Mag 7 now makes up 35% of the S&P 500. That's 7 stocks. I'm a little less worried about it. A couple reasons. Number one, throughout the last 100 years, 4% of stocks account for all the returns. And half of all stocks, more than half, don't even keep up with treasuries. In other words, the stock market, there's a Bessent Binder study that's pretty famous on this.
Yep.
It's really, most of the returns are a couple big horses. And the key is to ride those horses. And that's what the Mag 7 are for now. But let's say Micron, you see how it came out of nowhere. Now it's like in the top 10 or something. Micron, the good thing about market cap weighting is that it rewards the horses that are doing well. So you get a lot of that Bessent Binder juice in a market cap weighted. So I wouldn't worry so much about it. Now, the Mag 7 could be an antitrust issue because I looked and they've acquired 850 companies between the 7 companies. So they are almost like holding companies, right? Like Amazon bought MGM, they bought Amazon. That's just 2 of like 200 acquisitions. And so back in the day when GE ruled the S&P 500, GE made 70 acquisitions. That's a lot, but it's only a third of the acquisitions that Microsoft or Google made. And that's just two stocks, right? So the Mag 7, you could argue, is an antitrust problem. But if they're not going to enforce those rules, that just the way it's going right now, they can just buy all these companies. So you sort of are finding these Mag 7 have a lot of what you used to go to small caps for or value or whatever. Like they've hoovered up a lot of good companies. So I guess it's okay because you're getting a lot of exposure to all those things inside the Mag 7. So I look at the Mag 7 as like 70 stocks. The example I use is YouTube TV. Google bought YouTube. If they spun out YouTube, it would be the 19th biggest stock in America. And that's just one of 240 acquisitions by Google. So I will not really worry about it as an index concentration issue. Maybe it's antitrust, but I'm okay with it. And if you look at other countries, the U.S. having, I think, 40% of the top 10 stocks make up the index, most countries are 50 or more. So we're actually less concentrated than other countries. All that said, sure, these names have been up a lot, and can they go up higher? I think in general, the stock markets just feels a little stretched. Like people just know that it can't go up this much forever. I have another thesis with all of this, which is that the two things that are different than in eras past is A, Vanguard made all these amazing products that other people have too now, but like cheap beta is a product people get married to. And so nobody's like going in and out because of the manager screwing up. So they're married to their fund because it's a marryable fund. So the discipline is way higher. So these sell-offs don't turn into big drawn out things because they've got like what I call the Vanguard bid. These people just keep buying. They're just like not worried about your worries. The second thing is the government, right? The government now has this issue with the stock market being America's retirement fund, right? It's almost socialized in a way. And we saw that where the Fed came in COVID and they bought all the bond ETFs. I think it's possible the government ends up buying equity ETFs. They just bought a bunch in China. The Chinese government bought a ton of equity ETFs there. Bank of Japan did it. It's not abnormal. This is part of what we're going to go through. And this is why I think some people even think about all this and they're like, yeah, even if the market goes down for a month, the government won't let it go down for a long time. So I'm just not going to sell. So you have a real sturdy bid, I think, that helps keep the market up. And certainly each president likes to take credit for the stock market. So like, there's all these vested interests that keep the market up that are just not, that are a little beyond just valuations. And also earnings have been pretty good. So like, you've got like the artificial reasons that it's up, the Vanguard reasons, and the earnings reasons. So I generally am fine with everything. Like I try to be more appreciative than worried. And the other thing is nobody knows the future. And so, you know, I think if you're worried about the concentration or the valuations, what I would do is buy other things that would hedge that. So maybe you just keep putting into cash instead of buying more equities, or you buy long-dated treasuries or just a money market fund, or you could buy like hard assets. So maybe that's a way to do it, because what I wouldn't want to be is a person sitting there all day either rooting against the U.S. stock market, that's got to suck, or just like worrying every time it goes higher. Like, who wants to live in a state of fear or angst? You want to root on the U.S. stock market. So how do you root on the U.S. stock market while also being able to feel like you can sleep at night? That's also why buffer ETFs are pretty popular. But this is, I think, the solution to that, those concerns. But I understand them.
What's that wall of worry, right? You know, that the market is climbing. And so what about, there's been a lot of, there's been a significant rise in interest in commodity trading advisor-based funds, managed futures. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, they're pretty small still. There's,
yeah,
those tend to do well when the market's really having problems. Like 2022 was the last time we had like a really full bad year. And the managed futures ETF was one of the best flow getters, DVMF. Since then, it's come down a little. People tend to lean on alternatives when it's raining, like their umbrellas, you know. Nobody really is fixing the roof until it starts raining, right? Which, again, is probably bad. You should probably think about that now. That was my last point. Yeah.
If you know, diversifiers, putting different, yeah.
But managed futures is a good way to do it. We just had Corey Hofstein, who's the return stack guy, on ETF right. IQ. And what they do is they give you portable alpha products, which are like, we'll give you the S&P, but then we're going to do managed futures. And normally you would have treasuries in there because the futures you're getting on margin, but they just end up like buying the S&P with the money they got borrowed from the managed futures. So you get 100% S&P and 100% managed futures. This way you don't have to give up your S&P to get managed futures, because a lot of people don't want to sell S&P to get the alt. So this way you return stack them, so you don't have to give up your S&P. That's the idea. Those are doing okay. But pound for pound, these are tiny, tiny compared to the big blow of money that's buying equities and bonds, you know. But yeah, there's some inroads there with those strategies. But the hedge fund ETFs have struggled for many years. And I think mostly it's because the market just doesn't really ever go down for a long period of time, where those funds become the best performers for a couple years. We only have these like 1 month downturns. It's not enough time. So as of 2022 was really the only last time where we saw that. And DBMF did well. I think he got the $2 billion and it's a small indie fund. So, it's possible. But it's just harder with ETFs. I think hedge fund strategies tend to be more popular with institutions who are really more into Sharpe ratio, and they have to keep their risk down, and they want stuff different than Vanguard anyway. That's where hedge fund stuff is even more appreciated. With the ETF world, it's usually advisors, and, you know, like go back to the IBM, like a lot of them, you know, are like, well, I can't get fired for doing a 60-40, you know, VOO and BND. Well, if I add this managed futures, then I got to explain what it does, or it's a drag on the portfolio. So there's a little bit of a career risk and complication issue, education issue with advisors, those kind of strategies, I think.
Yeah, that probably applies right across the board on alternatives in general. It's just the runway for education. I think you know, the most implicit thing that you just said, Eric, was you know, something that's been talked about you know, in a lot of conversations that we've had, but just across the industry, is this juggernaut of defined contribution, defined benefit buying of indexes, right? That's really holding, that's that monthly inflow that comes, you know, hell or high water. It doesn't matter what's going on in the market. That that dollar cost averaging, you know, in the, I don't know how many billions of dollars every month. What is it, like $50 to $100 billion a month?
Yeah, it's a lot. Now, people could stop doing that. They could get worried. But what I, again, what I think is different is that, A, there's way more money now. And also the Trump accounts, which are this new thing that just came out this month, the 50% of people who don't have stocks are now going to have a chance to be, have for the stock market. So most of America is going to be owning stocks. This is this is now a, you know, we were socializing the stock market to a degree, for better or worse. And the other thing is the people who own, say a target date fund in their 401k and use passive funds, they're married. They feel like I got a good product. And if the market goes down, what am I going to do? Like switch over to something that's hot 1 minute and then I'll transfer it to the wrong. And I think they've come to some peace with behavior and they're like, I'm just going to just keep investing and I'll cash out when I'm done. And like the people have gotten way smarter. But again, Vanguard making products that are marryable is half the battle. I think Bogle got underrated in that. Everybody knows he's the, you know, father of passive, but he's also the father of good behavior because once a product is something that you feel like you have the best deal, it would take a lot for you to leave. And it would take like multi-years, I think, before you would start to shake out any of the sort of core Vanguardian types. It's possible. Yeah. I mean, or we could have like a real sharp, quick downturn. But then you got to ask yourself, if stocks are down 30%, you don't think the government or the Fed is going to step in? That's a question everyone should ask. And that's interesting, right? Like, and if you do think that, which I think most people do, they're just like, well, I'm not going to sell if it goes down 10% then, because,
I'll just wait.
Fed put. Yeah.
Yeah. Eric, just to remind people, you are the author of a landmark book on John Bogle.
So I wrote a book called The Bogle Effect.
Yeah.
Because I think I was going to call it The Vanguard Effect, but I'm like, you know, Vanguard is a company and that's great. And it's going to be run by normal people. And it is now. And over the years, it's going to probably start to look more like just a regular corporation. Bogle was the anomaly in physics. This guy was weird. He was wired differently. And he totally changed everything. I think he's the most impactful person that has come to investing or Wall Street in the last 50 to 100 years. Buffett's right there with him. I think those two are like in a league of their own. So I just wanted to explore this book, and Vanguard's taken in like so much money. I was like, thought the data was really powerful. So I wrote that book on them. It's obviously on Amazon. And I also wrote a book called The Institutional ETF Toolbox, which is specifically about like the ETF industry, how it got started, and like, you know, how to evaluate ETFs and pick the one that's right for you.
And you're also the host of, I think, one of the most amazing podcasts on ETFs, Trillions.
Trillions is new to the podcast. That aged well, by the way. Because at the time there was the hedge fund show called Billions. And so we were like, let's do Trillions. And it ended up being the right ball. That's on Spotify. That's free. And then there's also a TV show I co-host called ETF IQ every Monday at noon on Bloomberg TV. But you can Google that and watch old episodes too. So those are some free ways to get me. And I'm on X a lot and LinkedIn.
Awesome. Eric, really great to have you and catch up with you. I'm not wondering at all what's got you so busy these days. You know, when you go from one ETF launch a day to four ETF launches a day, you know, that's four times more work for you. So it's no surprise.
$9 to $10 billion in flows a day.
That's crazy.
There's a lot to do. Yeah. I'm security currently. So
wonderful. Eric, thank you so much. Really great to see you. And great to catch up with you. Pleasure always.